Hi and welcome everybody to this special event. Thank you very much for coming along. My name's Richard Holden. I'm a professor of economics here at UNSW Business School and director of the Manos Innovation Laboratory in Education. Let me begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the lands on which we meet, the Bidjigal people of the Eora Nation, pay my respects to elders past and present, and extend that respect to any First Nations people with us here today. It's a real treat to get to introduce two of my favourite people to talk about the past, present and future of economics. Speaking of the future of economics, Rachel Meagher is, and I can say this with my hand on my heart, and I actually do know, one of the best empirical economists of their generation. And we are lucky and delighted and really thrilled that they have joined us at UNSW. And going to be part of helping make the best economics department in the Southern Hemisphere even better. Andrew Lee is an old friend of mine. Well, he's not that old, but our friendship goes back a very long way. I'm roughly the same age, so I'm not going to cast any aspersions. Andrew is prolific in literally every way, as a writer, as a speaker, as a runner of extremely long distances, which now extend to running extremely long distances on uneven terrain, because running 100 kilometres on bitumen is apparently not enough of a challenge. And he's also quite prolific in what his fearless leader once described as fighting Tories. He was definitely a loss to the economics profession when he went into politics, but a very large gain to the House of Representatives and Australian democracy. Now, the last time I introduced Andrew, or my job was to introduce Andrew, I accidentally introduced Michelle Grattan instead. And I thought I'd done quite a nice job. I told a little joke. Michelle seemed quite pleased with things. I sat down next to Andrew, mind you, and he politely but relatively pointedly wrote me a little note and said, "You had one job." Well, mate, today I have done my job. So I am going to sit back and enjoy the show. Rachel, over to you.
Thanks, Richard. And thanks, Andrew, for being here and launching your book at UNSW. It's really exciting. I know that, you know, as an old UCID boy, that the loyalty must have run deep, but we're very happy that you're with us. We've got about an hour for the event. I'm going to spend about 40 minutes asking you questions and having a conversation, and then we'll open up the floor to questions. For anyone who's interested, and there'll be roving mics and stuff. I really enjoyed the book, but what I'm thinking about, especially after the introduction Richard just gave, you're an incredibly busy person. I'm wondering why this book, and, you know, given everything else that obviously you have to spend your time on, what's the motivation for writing this book?
It's a great opening question. Let me quickly, Rachel, just say a couple of opening comments. First of all, I acknowledge we're speaking on the lands of the Gadigal people and pay respect to their elders and to First Nations people present. Secondly, to say what an honour it is to have my mate Richard host me here in this wonderful venue. And third, Rachel, to say what a treat it is to be speaking with you, because you're one of the economists in Australia who is doing some of the most interesting empirical work. And for anyone that isn't aware of your prolific research output, I'd encourage them to check out your website. But why Shortest History of Economics? In part, it's because I was asked. Chris Feek from Black Ink has been running a series of Shortest History of books, Shortest History of India, Shortest History of Democracy, Shortest History of the World, which you'd think would have covered the field already, but apparently there's room for others. Morris Gleitzman is doing the Shortest History of Wine, he told me the other day. And the temptation of trying to distill a discipline down to a book was too good to refuse. But it was tempting, I think, Rachel, because you would be aware as an economist, but some non-economists are often not, that the most powerful insights from our discipline often come from the things we teach in first year, not the things we're teaching to our PhD students. The notion of the sunk cost fallacy, of thinking about trade-offs. Every time someone asks you to do something, there is an opportunity cost of a thing not done. The notion of thinking at the margin. What would be the impact of one more thing rather than thinking only about the average? and the power of big data, which really is the secret sauce behind economists' willingness to branch out over recent decades into making contributions into areas previously the scope of criminologists, I see Don Wedderburn here, or health researchers, or psychologists. So the ability of economists to wrestle with data is the reason that there's breakout boxes in Shortest History of Economics about the economics of sport or the economics of art.
Okay, I see. I think there is something really valuable about retreading that kind of foundational ground from a new perspective. That's something that like I actually do in teaching, and I think it's also true in statistics, that like actually the core of these disciplines are in some ways like the most interesting, the most kind of fertile and contentious. So when you were writing it, did you, obviously you're departing from how economics is usually presented. Did you have any concern about like, you know, that people are, you know, so for those of you that haven't had a chance to read the book, there's a lot of intentional highlighting female economists, highlighting that there are queer economists that have made a lot of contributions, people of color, women of color in particular. Did you have any concern that there was going to be like your book in the culture war, that people were going to get really mad?
I think it's just weird when you read past histories of economics, which obviously one of the first things you do when you get a project like this is to go and read all the other books. It's just a succession of dead white males, just cascading from one British person, one British bloke to another British bloke to an American bloke to a French bloke and back to a British bloke again. And yet there's such extraordinary stories outside the Anglosphere. Justin Lin, who has served as the World Bank chief economist, at a young age defected from Taiwan to China, swimming across the strait that separates the nearest Taiwanese island from the Chinese mainland, and then has made significant contributions in our thinking about development economics. The impact of Francis Perkins, who was influential on FDR's decision to set up Social Security, and the way in which her thinking was shaped by being there in New York as one of the worst industrial disasters in American history happened, a fire which killed a whole lot of workers because the safety exits were barricaded by bosses that didn't want the workers to pop out for a short break. And all these figures are the tapestry of modern economics, but have been largely omitted from it. So it felt like it was the natural thing to do in writing in 2024 to look at the diversity of the field, which really is much more exciting than the Anglosphere blokes.
Yeah, I think there's I think sometimes for people that do fit in that mold or that are more comfortable with the sort of straight white male lineage, I think there's this question of like, why is that necessary or why is that important? But I think, you know, for myself coming to economics, you know, it's really clear when you lay it out how central like contributions of people who are not straight white men have always been. Mm. And that's also something that I try to bring in when I teach as well. So like, I really loved your kind of reference here to the fact that Keynes is bisexual and not kind of glossing over that, but also not treating it as like, oh, it's titillating, as sort of saying like, this is who this person was. Another great example, if we were ever to write a history of statistics, is that Kolmogorov, who came up with the foundations of probability, was very likely gay. It was in Russia at the time, so it wasn't publicly out. But yeah, so I think there is this sort of hidden history. Did you have this, was there a sense of urgency for you in correcting the record?
Well, I did want people to be able to see themselves in the story of economics. And I guess that must be a huge priority for you as you're teaching. That awareness that if people can't see themselves in the discipline, they're less likely to stay with it. But if it's the notion that this is an expansive discipline, then people feel more included. Now, Freakonomics is not a perfect book, but one of the great things that Freakonomics did was to encourage people to think about economics as a discipline that could tell you much as much about crime and street prostitution and drug use as it could about exchange rates and gold prices. Money is important, and of course Richard's just produced a terrific book on money, but it's also important to be able to think about how economics can help you in making everyday life decisions. And that's the style of economics that I wanted to weave in, while not missing out on the important role that Adam Smith and John Maynard Keynes and Milton Friedman played in shaping the architecture of the discipline and of the economic institutions that that govern trade and much else in the global economy.
Yeah, that makes sense. When you're kind of conceiving of a project like this, like how do you approach the research? Is it a process of whittling down, or is it a process of like, let's start with the presumption that nothing's in the book and everything has to earn its place in the book?
So the biggest question was structure. Initially, I began organizing the book thematically, and then just realized as the project evolved that I had to go back to chronologically. And I remember a lovely piece in the New Yorker a few years back by an editor who said, anytime you've got a choice between thematic or chronological, go chronological, because we're storytelling creatures and we think in terms of this happened and then this happened and then this happened. So that involved a whole lot of ripping material out and rejigging it and sometimes just throwing it away altogether, but trying to keep a steady pace. And so the book is able to start with hunter-gatherer civilizations, move through the agricultural revolution and the Indus Valley civilization, ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, and through the creation of the Grand Canal in China, and at the same time then start to weave in the intellectual history of the discipline. So it's two stories running alongside one another. As you'd know, Rachel, there's the history of the world through the lens of economics, and then there is the history of the development of economics.
I also felt like you had a strong focus on the history of technology in some sense. Do you feel like, when I was reading it, I thought it was very interesting, but I could imagine somebody who thought they might write the shortest history of engineering getting a bit mad that you've stolen some of the material. So I was wondering, like, how did you think about how much of the history of technological development can we claim as a history of economics?
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at the technologies which really advanced economic growth. So there's a few sort of quirky throwaways. There's the discussion of the mirror and how the mirror, according to Stephen Johnson at least, helped fuel a more self-focused culture in which people were more worried about their appearance, because suddenly for the first time they could see a clear image of themselves, not the distorted image out of a piece of steel or looking into a river. But by and large, I was thinking about the technologies like the steam engine and the spinning jenny, electrification and artificial intelligence, which really transformed industries and economies. And the way in which sometimes those technologies' promise wasn't realized early on. Economists talk about general purpose technologies, which can be put to use in ways that their inventors didn't envisage. And you see in electrification the way in which it took factory owners a while to recognize that electrification meant that you could reorganize the factory in a way that was much more efficient. But that took decades. And likewise with artificial intelligence, a technology which is being used in a whole lot of white-collar jobs now, I think we're only just looking at just at the cusp of thinking about how artificial intelligence will rejig jobs and produce significant productivity surges, but also create work in a way in which we haven't seen before.
I feel like there's a lot of emphasis on that in your book. Like if we go back to the Triangle Shirtwaist fire disaster, I think certainly when I was an undergraduate in econ, the theme was like sort of more efficient markets, or like, well, no one would want to work in a factory where the doors are bolted shut, so that's not a problem that could happen in the world. And, you know, I do think there's an issue of like especially in more left-wing or progressive spaces, of economists coming off sort of looking quite naive in that old mode. So do you have a sense of, like, is there a desire for economists to kind of be less naive? Like, is that part of the intention here?
There's a lot of, I mean, I remember when I was studying economics at Harvard Kennedy School, there was a course called Markets and Market Failure. And one of my more free market professors in the econ school rolled their eyes at the notion that you'd begin by talking about market failure. Their view was that you should begin by talking about markets, and that market failure was a postscript that you'd bolt on the end. For me, though, Rachel, I do think very much about the role of market failure throughout the book. The market failure of how we deal together with the challenge of climate change, the market failure of mass unemployment, which is a huge waste of human potential, the market failure of monopoly power and the way in which that can hurt consumers, and then Joan Robinson's insight of the market failure of monopsony power and the way in which firms can also have power in hiring that can effectively drive down wages. And all of that means that there's more discussions of the role of unions than you might see in the typical introductory economics book.
The other kind of related discussion is the origin of the term dismal science. So something that I was really happy with that I always worry about in like the public consciousness is this notion that economists are typically aligned with the right wing, or that we're sort of typically aligned with conservative or imperialist forces. And I think it's still relatively unknown, and this book does, I think, attempt to correct the record to say that, you know, the origin of economists being called the dismal science is economists pointing out that slavery, in addition to being immoral, is also very economically inefficient. It's not a good way to set up markets. And I was wondering if you had this sense of like wanting to correct that, or wanting that particularly to permeate public consciousness. Does that bother you when you know, it's sort of assumed that economists would say, well, you know, it probably is efficient to abuse employees or have slaves or whatever, that's the image people have of us?
Yes, I think it's part of the book is also about talking about how exciting economics is and the fun ways in which it can help us look at a range of different issues. That's true in highly sensitive issues such as slavery. And you know, it was interesting as my writing developed in that area that my early drafts refer to slaves and my later drafts more appropriately refer to enslaved people, which is how it is enslaved people are appropriately termed. And also just to see the role that economics has played in global integration and the value that can come from a connected world in building tolerance and in propagating that notion, once dubbed dismal, that all human beings are of equal worth. If we're utilitarians, then fundamentally we should take the view that the happiness of each person is of equal weight. And that should lead you to a much more connected world, and a world which places significant weight on the well-being of people in poor countries. So there's a lot more discussion of the economic growth challenges of our region, the way in which the tiger economies in Southeast Asia developed based on export-oriented, outwardly focused growth. The different trajectories that countries that have moved from poverty, moved from low income to middle income have followed. You look at the success stories of Korea, but also the poverty traps and why so many countries in Africa in particular have stayed persistently poor. One economist once wrote, once you begin thinking about economic growth, it's hard to think about anything else. And considering the problems of poverty and inequality globally is one of the huge challenges that economics has confronted.
So Switching gears to a couple more kind of examples in the book, one of the things I really liked is how you went out of your way to bring in these examples from less developed countries or different societies that are structured differently, but kind of relating them back to how we imagine ourselves and like how our economy is set up. So in the book, you gave this really interesting example of the Yap Island rocks. So for those of you that don't know, or I'm sure actually there's several examples of particularly islander nations where they have large rocks that they essentially use as currency. And they sort of say, well, if you build me this house, then half the rock will be yours. And I had heard that over the years, but in your book is the first time that I've ever seen that compared to the Federal Reserve's gold bullion underneath Fort Knox. Like, is that a comparison that occurred to you, or does that have an intellectual lineage? Like, where did you come up with that or find that?
Like most ideas, I'm sure somebody else has written it down as well, but it felt original when I wrote it. The early notions of money were, of course, that it needed to have some physical value. So precious metals tended to be used, and the Yapis used beautiful stone-carved artifacts. The challenge with these artifacts was that they were so heavy that they couldn't easily be moved from one person's house to another when a trade took place. So as you've said, Rachel, the community would simply recognise that the stone had now changed ownership, even although it hadn't physically moved. People had chuckled at the Yapis for years, but it did strike me that that's exactly what happens when central banks buy or sell gold. They don't typically move the gold from one place to another. It stays in the vaults of the bank in which it's owned, and an electronic ledger is updated. So in some sense, modern gold bullion trades are an awful lot like trades were on the Yap Islands.
So the other thing that was kind of new to me, but this might reflect my lack of archaeological knowledge, is the idea that more unequal societies leave a greater archaeological footprint, because in order to build a massive structure, you need a handful of people that are extremely wealthy. And because ancient human civilizations just didn't have that much prosperity, that necessarily means that other people are not having enough. So in the book, you sort of mentioned that. What I took from that is that there's a bias in the historical record that is, if we just look at the archaeological record, it shows a record of a very unequal, hierarchical, competitive species. But actually, that could just be selection bias. It could just be survivorship bias. Was that something that you kind of came to early in the book writing process? Because it seems like that might have infused the rest of the book, or was that something that came up towards the end?
So you've articulated a point which is much deeper than I talk about in the book, and I think that line of inquiry would be fascinating to explore. In the book, I was simply looking for an ancient culture which hadn't been that wouldn't necessarily be over familiar to most readers. I figured that if I was to spend my time talking just about the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians, then people would feel they were I was tilling pretty familiar ground. But to talk about the Indus Valley civilization was to talk about a civilization which had potentially the world's earliest use of ploughing, and was surprisingly egalitarian. The story is of many civilizations after the agricultural revolution was that the agricultural revolution created the potential for rapid economic growth, but in fact a lot of that potential was quickly captured by a group of, let's be honest, let's call them politicians, who stepped in, set up their own standing armies, kept the population in check, and expropriated much of the surplus. What they did with that surplus is, can be dubbed the edifice complex. They built huge monuments to their gods or to themselves, and from that you get many of the great buildings ancient Greek, ancient Rome, and of course the Egyptian pyramids. But there was another way of doing things, and the Indus Valley civilization was that much more egalitarian civilization. The thing is, of course, as you point out, Rachel, if you don't build those huge edifices, then later archaeologists can't find you. And so the Indus Valley civilization was only discovered by archaeologists relatively recently.
The other thing that's related to this is you discussed the Kalahari Bushmen, which I think is super exciting. I feel like my own experience in Botswana and South Africa and kind of seeing what the current situation of Kalahari Bushmen is, I think is really, it's really interesting, but it goes back to that point of saying, this is a group of people that live in this extremely communitarian way. Almost as a result of that, they're not building massive edifices or, you know, these kind of settlements. And so we have this tendency, it feels therefore less important because of how we're kind of intellectually trained. So yeah, there seems to be, I think, kind of a general problem that we have. So will you imagine that this book is that primarily aimed, do you think, at like prospective students of economics, or who's the audience that you think kind of needs that lesson? I was going to say re-education to a politician on stage. That was probably not be a good idea.
I want it to be a book that anyone who is curious about economics could pick up and enjoy. I wanted to make sure that there were enough recasting of the story of economics that a practicing economist such as yourself or Richard could pick it up and enjoy it. But I also wanted it to be the kind of book that my mum, who's here with her friends today and who did not study economics, might find interesting because it cast light on some of the issues that she's excited by. So it was aimed at a broad general readership. And that's really what the Shortest History Of series is aimed at doing. If you need specialist knowledge to go and read a Shortest History Of book, then somebody's made a mistake along the way. It ought to be the kind of book you can pick up and dip into. And it was interesting. It was when they went to sell the international rights that the British publisher said, now, it might be fun to have some breakout boxes here. And that gave me the license to suddenly put in a bunch of things that hadn't fitted into the historical chronology, to talk about Sadie Alexander, the first African-American woman to get a PhD in economics, and the discrimination that she faced, to tell the story of David Gallinson's Creative Cycles and how that applies to novelists and filmmakers and painters and poets. And to talk about the economics of sport and the role of incentives in sport. The fact that if you have a big gap in the prize between first place and second place, you get faster times or lower golf scores because sports people, like others, respond to incentives.
So when you're trying to incorporate that type of material or that research into the book, I wondered, and I think this is an issue that basically anyone that writes almost introductory texts has to deal with. How much do you want to kind of alert the audience to the fact that like research is an ongoing process, there are going to be revisions in our understanding of the things that we're talking about, we know that empirical research is subject to all sorts of distorted incentives and biases itself. So I noticed that there's relatively little discussion of those risks in this book, and I'm wondering how you made that decision. I think it's really tough. So like teaching introductory classes, I think I go too far the other way, and I'm always like, here's the current understanding, but it could be totally wrong. And then the students are like, great, why did we come to class?
Yeah, it's a really interesting challenge, isn't it? I mean, you've got now the replication crisis roiling social science. The most famous example of which is a paper about misleading conduct in the purchase of vehicles. And in the course of writing that paper, it now appears that of the four authors, two of them independently falsified different studies. And this is a paper about falsification. So that's at the nub of the replication crisis. And many people are wondering what this says about empirical economics. And for those of us who work in empirics, that's a deep concern. I have hinted more strongly at that in a past book, Randomisters, which was talking about randomised trials and the way in which randomised trials may be less vulnerable to falsification than natural experiment techniques, where the researcher makes more judgments as to how to set up the analysis. But I didn't want to get too deep in the weeds of econometrics on this one. Maybe I made a mistake, because the replication crisis really is one of the most important things happening in economics right now, and the way the discipline responds to it, I think, is heartening, although we've obviously got a ways to go.
Yeah, it is really hard, though, to try to think how much of that should we tell. Or, like, sometimes, I mean, we talk about the replication crisis a lot on Twitter, and then sometimes you'll see other social scientists say, like, you shouldn't be talking about this in public, because it's going to give ammunition to anti-science people or people who think, like, oh, well, there are these problems in empirical research, therefore my opinion is just as good as any other source of information. So I think, you know, there is always that fine line. I think you don't want to sell yourself short too much. Like, you did mention some, like, relatively important aspects of that, like the selection bias story of the planes in World War II. I think it was World War II, right?
Yes.
So not to necessarily get into it, but I didn't realize that it was Abraham Wald who sort of realized that if we only analyze the damage report of the planes that come back, we can't necessarily infer that the areas that are the most damaged are the weakest areas, because these are the planes that come back. So we're missing the planes that are so damaged that they never come back. Was that something that, you know, you necessarily, like, you know, in some sense that's history of statistics. So what's the kind of nexus there with economics?
Well, the Wald estimator is, of course, used by a range of econometricians in a whole host of different contexts, including the estimating the impact of the Vietnam draft on later labour market experience. But Abraham Wald's willingness to dive in and help solve a thorny problem in the midst of worst conflict of the 20th century is, to me, deeply fascinating. And the way in which you can illustrate it, Rachel, as you've seen from the book, with a picture of the planes that returned. The planes that returned were, of course, seriously damaged, but because they made it back, the areas that weren't hit were not necessarily the areas that didn't need to be reinforced. So that understanding and the way in which Wald shaped statistics was, for me, deeply fascinating. And to see economists diving into to a debate like that, much as physicists look to the role of the scientists who served on the Manhattan Project, the impact of economists at some of these crisis moments is really fascinating, as well as our ability to use the tools of economics to think about those conflicts themselves. So at the start of the Civil War, the disparity between the two sides is massive, and yet the South, through better military tactics, is able to drag the war out from what should have been over in a year or two to a 4-year war, and similarly in World War II, the difference in terms of land and armaments and people and economic resources at the outset strongly favours the Allies, and yet the far superior tactics of the Nazis drags that conflict out far longer than it should have done. economics can tell you about who's going to win, but tactics did make a big difference in terms of the duration of those conflicts.
I think that that's another kind of example of how, you know, economics is kind of so much a part of the history of the world. So for me, like, this was very kind of personally gratifying because I actually started as an undergrad history major. And then it was through actually studying war that it became kind of evident to me that if you don't understand economics, it's going to be hard to understand war. And then if you don't understand war, it's hard to understand the 20th century. And then it's hard to kind of go forward. So I think that there's a lot of that kind of tied into the fabric of your book, and I really appreciated reading that. So I think I should probably stop like monopolizing the discussion. I think we've got like 20 minutes for audience questions, and there's going to be a roving mic. And I want to especially encourage any students that are here to ask questions. And Andrew actually also wanted to encourage students that are here to ask questions. So we wanted to, Andrew's generously offered that at the end of the session, the student that asked the best question will receive a free copy of the book. So please, yeah, get going. We've got our first student here.
Hey, Andrew. Great conversation, by the way. Two things. One, just a warning about randomized trials. When we were doing the randomized trial of the drug court, the mechanism for choosing whether you were going to go into treatment or control was the date on which you'd been arrested, and we found the legal aid lawyers were manipulating the date of arrest to get their favoured people into the treatment group. Pity about that data, we had to throw it away. But the question I wanted to ask you is this. Empirical economics has made much more progress in understanding and working on crime and justice problems in the States than it has in Australia. I acknowledge straight off that we do have some great economists working on that problem from New South Wales, but any thoughts on how we can encourage more involvement of economics and economists into problems of crime and justice?
So, Don, probably the thing that got me most excited about the economics of crime was hearing you on the radio as the head of the Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research. because in a kind of in a hyperventilated, always kind of fierce ideological discussion about crime, you were able to cut through by saying, well, here's the data, this is what's going up, this is what's coming down. And for me as a young public policy person, that was enormously appealing. But we don't have as many of those voices in the crime, in the economics of crime debate as we could have. So in some sense, the answer is we need a Don Weatherburn of the economics of crime, who is following in the Gary Becker, Steve Levitt lineage, somebody who is talking about incentives, who is not demonising criminals as some kind of other species, but is thinking of people who commit offences as being humans like the rest of us who are responding to incentives and we as society needing to adjust the incentives in a way in which we make the community as safe as possible while also minimising the unnecessary suffering, ideally, and so we have less crime and less punishment.
Thank you. I'm afraid I've not had a chance to read the book yet, but I was just wondering, you had a wonderful opportunity to zoom out, and I guess in the academic world, you're stuck in sort of a specific micro-discipline. I was wondering whether the process of zooming out across the history of the whole discipline allowed you to see some connections or things that clicked that maybe aren't appreciated by the discipline as a whole.
What a lovely question. I was very aware that when you bring in the non-Anglo economists, that you start to see the value of economics in fostering global integration. So the story of trade is often told through David Ricardo's campaign against the corn laws, but to bring in the economists from the global south is to see the importance for those countries of connecting up to the global markets. And if you're a country where the local market is very small, it's very hard to specialise unless you can access the international markets. Specialisation, I guess, is one of the big ideas of economics and one of the big ideas I was looking to convey in the book. Most of us don't cut our own hair or fix our own cars or make our own clothes, and yet there's still a whole range of very smart people who believe that each country should try and do everything. Specialisation is one of the main reasons for prosperity within the domestic labour market, but specialisation by countries can also foster prosperity at a global level. And seeing that come through a whole range of the non-Western economists was insightful for me.
Thank you very much, Andrew. And first of all, thank you for the concept of subjective copyright, that as long as something feels original, then you can go for it. I had a question, and I think it's back to the dismal science. I'm helping one of your colleagues at the moment on First Nations digital inclusion, and we're getting a bit caught up in, do you argue for it on the clear moral ground that this is clearly the right thing to do? There's an emerging stream of thought that right to communications is an emerging human right, so you kind of take the moral ground, but there are just so many reasons to advocate it, one of which is the economic opportunity, not least because there's so many examples of mismatch of supply and demand where government provides things that actually aren't fit for purpose and don't actually help First Nations people. So back to the dismal science question, where you've got an economic reason and a moral reason, I think you might have some unifying theory of science and morals.
So I'm fundamentally a utilitarian. You can identify areas where utilitarianism starts to feel troubling. The classic thought experiments that you have five patients who are each on the verge of death, and each of them needs a different body organ, and through the door walks one healthy person. Is it appropriate to take the life of that one person and then to harvest their organs for the five who would otherwise die? Well, a pure utilitarian view would say yes. I think almost all of us in the room would say no, that's not appropriate. But aside from those edge cases, utilitarianism feels appropriate, and focusing on the greatest good for the greatest number has been an important part of economics. One of the things that we've seen in recent years is that the so-called Easterlin paradox, the idea that once a country reached a certain level of income, that more money didn't buy more happiness, was largely an artifact of small survey bias, just not showing up the true pattern. And now that we have happiness surveys across 150 or more countries, we can see quite clearly a relationship between the percentage changes in income and changes in happiness, which continues right up the income distribution. So for that, I think I'm largely utilitarian in the sort of Peter Singer mould. But one who is a little cautious about the moments it might not apply, and aware that we need to make sure that we're measuring as broadly as possible. So thinking about the work of feminist economists who've focused on measuring household production, for example, a utilitarian view that only looks at what's going on in the market sector can be badly wrong.
Thanks, Andrew. So I've got a comment or a discussion and then a question. So my comment is about what you said about World War II, and I just want to set the record a bit that the Nazis did defeat the greatest army in Europe in 6 weeks, utterly defeated them, and what draws the war out is a Nazi mistake of trying to invade Russia in the winter. So this is just a comment on what you said, because I just, history matters to me, and so I want to be precise on that, and maybe we can have discussion. But my question is, in the process of writing this book, I just want to know whether you had a prior that was changed by the material that you reviewed and the depth that you have over the history of economics. So, you know, did the process of writing this book change your mind about one thing or several things?
Yes. I changed my mind about lots of different things. One was just that... So I did deliberately set out about writing a more inclusive history of economics, and I thought that would be harder than it turned out to be. I remember Nicholas Kristof wrote a column about a decade ago. He said he'd looked back over his previous columns, he'd noticed that whenever he had to cite experts, he mostly cited men, and he decided that he would set himself a goal of quoting the same number of female experts as male experts. He said he thought this is going to be pretty hard. His response then was, it turned out to be surprisingly easy. He had to make two more extra phone calls, ask for some more connections, and suddenly there was this bevy of female experts who balanced out his columns. And I found pretty much the same, that all you had to do was spend an extra half hour researching, and suddenly there was this really interesting story of women who had shaped economics. You know, Joan Robinson's tale is a remarkable one, not only because of the sexism that she faced within Cambridge and the fact that she only was made a full professor at the very end of her career, but also the intellectual dexterity with which she operated, and the fact that when one of the final editions of her famous book on monopsony power came out, she wrote not a glowing foreword but a critical foreword of her own book, saying, well, here are the ways in which my views have changed. So my views changed, I think, in seeing what an integral role those women economists had played and how readily accessible their stories were.
Thank you for a brilliant talk and an amazing book. It's a history of economics, but at the end you touch lightly on the future. What areas are exciting you about the next 20 years? When you revise this, let's say 20 years, you know, the second shortest history of economics, what do you think you'll put in there that will be of interest to people then?
So at that stage, I guess it'll be the longest history of economics by the time we draw it out. But Julian, I'm... like probably half of you at least, fascinated by artificial intelligence. I recently did a talk where I used AI data analysis tools for the first time and was struck by how adept they were in cleaning data, analysing data, and graphing it. AI has fascinating blind spots and extraordinary strengths. If you ask it to provide a set of citations, then it makes them up. It doesn't just make up one or two, it makes them all up, at least in the models that I've used. You will get a plausible sounding author, a plausible sounding title, a plausible sounding journal, and then some random numbers for the volumes and page. It doesn't understand that a citation is one discrete thing. But it soon will. I mean, the models we're using now are the worst AI models we'll ever use for the rest of our lives. Conversely, if you ask it to come up with a new title for something, it's brilliant. One of its superpowers is in coming up with titles. It's great on generating graphics. And my youngest son, Zachary, and I have been enjoying the power of AI engines for graphics. And it's a terrific editor. I'll put a lot of my text into ChatGPT-4 and just ask it to suggest any corrections. And invariably, it'll come back and notice things that can be tightened up or fine-tuned. I'm struck, Julian, by the study that BCG does with its management consultants, where they do a one-day mock exercise. Half the group is randomly chosen to use ChatGPT, half the group not. And those that use ChatGPT produce work that is 25% faster and 40% better when judged either by human raters or AI raters, who, by the way, line up fairly closely. So the power and potential, and also the challenges for unemployment and the singularity are going to occupy a lot of our brain power, I think.
Okay, we're going to do one last question. Oh, there's a pass on that. Okay, going.
We do have a student question from to whom we can hand this away.
We have a student question prize that I guess now that we've talked about World War II, this is going to be like, was not awarded this year sort of thing. Look, thank you, Andrew and Rachel, very much. Please join me in thanking them for a great discussion.